Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers, those shakers, those film and TV makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, composers, VFX master wizards, sound editors, sound mixers, film editors, you name it, we talk to all of them. And I've been doing in between mold duty and flood cleanup after the flood of my home. I've been squeezing in some interviews for all of you, one of which you're going to hear today. It was a really tough call which one I was going to use in the first half of the show today. But I'll get to that in just a second. But joining us at the midpoint of the show today is writer, director, editor, and VFX guru, Sebastian Drouin. And if I said his name wrong, I have no French accent, so I'm sorry. Pam's sitting in the booth laughing at me. And we're going to be talking about Sebastian's new film that just came out on Friday here in the United States, Cold Meat. Wow. No pun intended, but it is a chiller and a thriller. It is creepy as creepy can be from a psychological standpoint. And he uses, it's a sensory film, so he uses sound. He uses visual to really immerse us in the events that unfold. So we're going to get into that more when Sebastian joins us at the midpoint of the show. But first, two of my favorite, this was a really tough decision, which exclusive interview I was going to open the show with today. Well, was it going to be Barry Pepper talking about his new film, Bring Him to Me? Was it going to be James Bramford talking about his new film, Air Force One Down? Or was it going to be Isham and Ian Nelms talking about their latest, which also just released on Friday, Red Right Hand? Wow, wow, wow. That was a big decision. Also, I've got some, I'm doing a slew of Masters of the Air interviews. And if you haven't seen Masters of the Air, Apple TV, see it, see it, see it. We're 5 episodes in. Get caught up. It is fantastic. It is based on the true story of the 100th Bombardier Division out of England, out of the UK, during World War II. It is phenomenal. But I think next week you're going to hear some of those interviews. But I opted for Isham and Ian Nelms and Red Right Hand. Red Right Hand. It sizzles. It crackles. It's moody. It's broody. It's bloody. It's action-packed. It stars Orlando Bloom, a new discovery, Chapel Oaks, Andy McDowell, who is pure evil, Scott Hayes, Garrett Dillahunt, Brian Garrity, Mo McRae, and of course, the Nelms boys bring back their favorite DP, Johnny Durango, who does an amazing job with this film. Composers, the Mondo boys are back, and of course, the Tratton Lee is editing again. And as you'll hear in the interview, you're going to find out who Tratton Lee really is. But the film, it is taut, tension-fueled intensity. I love the blood. There is great bloodletting and great color of the blood. But Red Right Hand, it's basically a story of Cash. He's played by Orlando Bloom. He's trying to live an honest and quiet life, taking care of his recently widowed brother-in-law and his niece, Savannah, played by Chapel Oaks. This takes place in the rural mountains of Odom County in Kentucky. the family tends to their farm while trying to move on from their troubled past. Unfortunately, Cash's brother-in-law, Finney, has made a deal with the devil, known as Big Cat, played by Andy McDowell, and he borrowed money. Well, the only way to get out from under Big Cat is Cash has to go back and do work. Three things for Big Cat, and that will release brother-in-law Finney from her debt. However, his morality comes into question here. It becomes darker, more violent, and you really blur the line of what is good, what is evil. Orlando Bloom is one of the best performances I've seen from him, and it is very much akin to what we saw from Christian Bale in Scott Cooper's film, Out of the Furnace. I got a very distinct Christian Bale Out of the Furnace vibe from Orlando in Red Right Hand. And as you're about to hear, in talking with Isham and Ian, that's one of the films that they also looked at. So we're all on the same page with the sensibility and the vibe that we're getting with Red Right Hand. It is neo-noir. It is a crime thriller. I think it is fantastic. It was shot on location in Lexington, Kentucky, in Campbellsburg, Kentucky. It is a great film to watch. I think you're going to enjoy it. It's riveting. But right now, take a listen to what Isham and Ian had to say about their film, Red Right Hand. And by the way, it's written by Jonathan Easley, who also wrote Fat Man, which is the Mel Gibson film that the boys had out 2 years ago. And it's always worth another watch, by the way. So take a listen to my exclusive interview with Isham and Ian Nelms talking Red Right Hand. Well, hello, gentlemen. How are you guys?
Hello. Debbie, how are you? Good to see you. Or I guess hear you. Just good to hear you.
Yes. I am so thrilled to be speaking with the two of you again. I have been chomping at the bit since Fat Man. And you have not disappointed me.
Oh, amazing. Well, I'm so glad that you enjoyed it. That's awesome.
Red Right Hand is so good. It is taut. There, it is a tension-fueled intensity to it. It is the best thing Orlando Bloom has ever done.
Oh, yes. I love to hear that. He worked so tremendously hard on that part. We can't tell you how thrilled we were to work with him and the experience we had working with him. I mean, he just absolutely went above and beyond. He spent months on that dialect. And then, weeks once we landed, trying to sort of really nail his character in the location that we were shooting.
The physicality that he brought as well, the body language, is something we've never seen from him.
He was working with the costume designer, Brittany, and he found those boots. And he came out to us and he goes, "Boys, what do you think of these boots?" And he's like, sort of strided around in them, and we're like, "Oh wow, what an interesting stride for Cash!" And he goes, "I know, I love it." So I mean, like, he just had such a blast building that character.
And it just shows on the screen. I was mesmerized by him and his performance, and it reminded me the whole film. You guys gave me right off the bat the Scott Cooper vibe, Christian Bale. From Out of the Furnace of about a decade ago.
We'd be lying if we didn't say we loved that movie. So, it's a great, great film. We love Cooper's work, and that's a huge compliment.
But watching this, the story itself, Jonathan's script, is so tight. I love the dialogue. It is so true to that Appalachian area of the United States. It's very authentic. And then you throw in Andy McDowell, who you automatically believe, just based on her own accent, naturally. Yep, it's in the hills. It's in, Appalachia. It's
cousins are marrying cousins, and it's just a free-for-all happening there. But here with her, you also elicit the most evil persona. And to watch her and Orlando go toe-to-toe,
yeah,
is...
Freckles, right?
Oh, my God. Guys, it's like, where did you start putting this masterful work together? Because this is masterful on multiple levels, and it shows because you brought the team back together. You brought Trayton back as your editor, Johnny, thank God, as your cinematographer, the Mondo Boys. So where did you start with this?
Well, I think it starts with the script. It starts with Jonathan's script, 100%. And when we read the script, like you, the dialogue was undeniable. It left off the page. The characters left off the page. And it really got us excited. And so that was the catalyst. That's when it engaged us fully. And then, of course, we had met with Orlando a couple of years ago, and we started thinking him for the role, and we thought if Orlando would get excited about this role, it would just be so incredible to have him play a character like this. He got back to us very quickly, loved it, and was like, I really want to sink my teeth into this. And he kept saying, this is a badass movie. I can't wait to do this. Like, this is going to be so awesome. He loved the characters. He loved that sort of Appalachia vibe, the landscape. And he was pumped about it. And then we actually had Andy came to us. It's interesting, Andy, because we had absolutely kicked Andy around as a big cat, but we didn't think she would want to do it, to be honest. We'd never seen her do anything like it, which excited us, but we didn't know if that was going to excite her. So the question was, is this going to be something she's even interested in? Thankfully, her agent asked it to her, unbeknownst to us, and said, hey, I think you're going to dig this. And then she loved it and then called us and said, hey, I really want to talk to you guys about doing this. We got on a Zoom call with her, and she was bringing the big cat vibe. She was in these leather pants, and it was a very pleasant conversation, but she was definitely showing us that she had an edge to her. It was awesome. Yeah.
On every level, you put together this great cast and elicited incredible performances. Garrett Dillahunt as Wilder is great. Scott Hayes is a perfect counterpoint to Orlando's Cash. You can see and understand immediately why Cash steps up to try and help his brother-in-law. You really believe the vibes that we have, but your point and counterpoint with your casting is really impeccably done. It's very well thought out. You get Brian Garrity in there as the sheriff, and then things we get to see by the third act, well, we know which side of the fence he's on, and it ain't Cash's. But so you took people out of their comfort zones and then pitted them against each other in character. And it just works beautifully, guys. Beautifully.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, for us, like, there is, like we always say, there's no part left behind. And we try to bolster every role as much as we can. And that's, you know, I mean, we're so blessed to get immensely talented people like Garrett, Scott, Brian, and then we discovered, like, Chapel Oaks, Mo McRae. I mean, we were just so thrilled. We brought back Jeremy Ratchford and James Lafferty, and we got Alex Park to do it. So it's just, I mean, for us, that's the sandbox, right? We get excited to come to work every day when we can have amazing collaborators out there.
Well, Chapel is a huge find. Chapel Oaks is a huge find for you guys. She's going places.
We totally agree. Couldn't agree more, and it was so evident from that the first time we Zoomed with her over the auditioning process. I mean, she had it. She just has that utter and complete ability to immerse herself in her characters. I remember we were sitting there, and she was on the call with her dad, and her dad was like, we wanted a scene that was a little more emotional, and she's like, okay, cool. And her dad's like, okay, you know, just jump into it, babe. And she goes, oh, no, Dad, give me a second. It's got to be real. Closed her eyes and got into the zone, and then just delivered a hell of a performance. And we were like, "Yep, this is our girl."
Yeah.
And it wasn't much of a conversation between anybody. Everybody on the team was like, "Yep, she's amazing."
That's it. Oh my God. Well, you guys know we got to talk about Johnny Durango and your cinematography, your visual tonal bandwidth. is off the charts. The way you use color, we have the muddy earthiness of the region. As things intensify in your second act, we get darker. Things get a little more claustrophobic inside. Then we get into the third act, and no spoilers, but we suddenly, by the film's end, we're clean, bright, light. We've got cash in that pristine, out-of-the-package Hanes t-shirt. He hasn't been this clean the entire film, but and it's so metaphoric and stunning. And then you balance, and you guys use widescreen for shootouts better than almost anyone I know, because you can have a shootout with two guys out in the field, and you're shooting it wide. You did this with Fat Man, with Mel. And it takes on a whole new level of intensity, because while there may be stuff happening in other places, you zoom in on just these two guys in the quote-unquote middle of nowhere in some cases, such as in the field or hiding behind a car or down an embankment, and the camera's dutching up, giving us the same level, eye level as the shooter. It is outstanding. Talk to me about working with Johnny and coming up with this incredible visual grammar for this story.
Well, look, Johnny, you know this. We love Johnny. He's like a third brother to us. I think we've made 5 movies with him at this point, and I can't imagine that stopping anytime soon. We all worked really hard on the preparation for this one. We watched a ton of stuff. We talked endlessly about the arc of the movie, the themes, what we wanted to happen when and where. We ventured into a little handheld aesthetic for this one, which we all loved and thought it gave it a natural, sort of like more naturalistic, voyeuristic, organic tone at times, especially in the family scene. Yeah, the family scenes, we wanted it to feel like snapshots, like candid, you're hanging out with them. And then obviously when we get to those elaborate choreographed shootouts, we all work together on the blocking and the storyboards, and we drill down and we make sure that no frame is extraneous, that nothing is done without purpose, right? Like we want to establish with big wides and then punch in for those details and those sort of nuanced little attributes that we want to find in the shootout. Like, yeah, we're big fans of you want those intense moments when you jump in, but you also really want to know the geography of the shootout and where everyone's at and how, as you're saying, it adds intensity when you really can understand where everyone's at and how they're playing off each other. And I think Johnny, like, as we all work together, I mean, Johnny's just getting better and better and better, and he was always great. But it really astounded us with how much he continues to improve and push himself. And, the color gradations and the theme gradations that he's working with now are such high-level stuff. We're just so impressed. Yeah, his attention to detail has always been wonderful, but he just keeps getting better and better.
You've really, the attention to detail, your visual attention to detail here is really something. And we see that whether we're in the intimate family setting at the home of Finney and Cash in Savannah, or if we're in Big Cat's living room. There's also an intimacy there of a very cloistered, claustrophobic, close-knit group. And I like that balance that we have, essentially two families, which plays into the whole idea of God, family, survival. The way that Johnny shoots it, especially in Big Cat's parlor or living room, when she's standing there with a gun, and if guys aren't gutsy enough to shoot someone, she'll do it herself. The hairs on the back of your neck stand up as you're watching this, because you feel like you are sitting right there next to her as she's holding that gun. It's amazing how we can have the warmth of the one house and then the chill of this other one, with both being essentially family scenarios. I just love how you design that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a lot of credit's got to go to Jordan Crockett, our production designer, as well. He did such a great job of, as you're saying, sort of keeping the family house warm and really making a lot of it. Yeah, I mean, he made a lot of those like subtle choices of making a lot of sharp objects in Big Cat's house. Yeah, it looked dangerous, and I think also like he and Johnny collaborated together marvelously. I know they had many conversations about what practical lights they're going to put in here, what's the texture of the wall, you know, like all those stuff. That was the cross-pollinization collaboration in the truest form.
Yeah, the production design is really outstanding. We get the whole socioeconomic understanding between Big Cat and between Cash and Finney. We see and understand why Finney would go to Big Cat for a loan, because he's got no money, he's got no nothing, and he's wallowing in grief. And he's got this daughter to raise that he really is incapable of doing on his own. But the production design and the details to what's within each home. And then right down to the vehicles that you guys are using here throughout. The rundown truck that's constantly being worked on by Cash, to the van, the transport vans, to Big Cat's fancier car. You really use production design and all of the set dress to tell us exactly where these people are in the socioeconomic strata of this microcosm. And it works really well.
I'm so glad you appreciate it. You know, for us, every car is a chariot or a representation of those who are behind the wheel, right? That's such an extension of their character for us and so important. We we're pretty particular about the sheet metal everyone drives around. We make them hunt high and low for stuff. And it doesn't always run, but it looks the part. And so, there's some problems there, pushing cars around when they're supposed to be running. But honestly, for us, it's got to match the character. It's got to set the vibe. It's got to be a complete picture. But those old, lovely cars do not come without their trials and tribulations.
Well, and in that region of the country, because of the economic condition of most of the people in that region, I expect to see the cars not running.
Yeah.
And you're working on them continually, trying to get them to start just once. And then you'll work on them again to get them to start twice.
Okay. Coming from a person who drives a car from 1984, I can tell you it's a reality for me.
Constant battle.
Yeah, it's a constant battle. But honestly, we can't commend Jordan Crockett, production designer, enough. It was a humble budgeted movie. We tried. We had high aspirations. We wanted to achieve far and beyond our budget, and Jordan did it in spades.
Absolutely. Now, how challenging was this edit here? Because you keep us going. You don't take your foot off. Your foot does not come off the gas pedal, and you build the tautness, the tension. What were your conversations and your work like with your editor, with Tratton Lee, to find the pace here and to hone in on these characters, this story, and the metaphor that it's telling?
So, slight confession. So with Tratton Lee, Esham and I do all the editing, and it's very much a moniker for both of us.
Yes, I realize that. I know that from before.
Yeah. So I guess when we're editing this thing, I mean, we were definitely a character first. Like this, and the script very much has that building to it, right? That you come in with these characters, you get to know them, you get sucked into their world and their plight, and then you start to ratchet it up. You start to try to get these people in a lot of trouble, and then fight their way out of it, basically. And hopefully, as an audience, you're invested now that you've spent time with them and you've fallen hopefully in love with them, and you see that it's turmoil and you know the dynamic of the family and the characters. And now, hopefully, those stakes are elevated when you get into those action scenes. And that's the balance we're running. That's the balance we're running, right? Is keeping you invested, keeping all those wonderful family moments, keeping all those moments between Wilder and Cash that you get their relationship. And then starting to pepper in these other characters and having them, hopefully it feels like a nice flow and a nice build. And then before you know it, you're up to your neck in it with the characters. And then obviously the action and tension and those thrill elements really start pouring in that second half. It was a fun movie to edit, but again, the script was built so nicely.
Mm-hmm.
we felt like we definitely had a good guide. And then once we brought the Mondo Boys in to score it, especially the pacing in that last third. They did such a great job, and we were really pushing them. And they just, those guys deliver every time. They really step it up and bring their A game every time. Their score is so, we're so happy with their score.
And I'm glad you mentioned their work in the third act. You know, they really do bring it in that third act. And it's unrelenting, and it just escalates everything to the final climactic moments. Now, I'm curious, because you're cutting yourself on this film, did you do any editing during the course of shooting, or because you knew that you're cutting it, were you kind of editing in your minds for what you were shooting to try and cut down on perhaps some coverage shots, knowing you could block this way, or whatever? Because you ultimately were going to have the hand on the knife.
100%. We and I are very, very thorough in our storyboarding process and what shots we need and exactly when we want to be in those shots. It's not 100% every time, obviously, but we definitely have a plan when we go out there. And if we have a bit and we don't need any more of it, we'll walk away from that. We won't sit there and shoot a whole thing because we may need something later. It's like, no, we got the piece we need, we're moving on. There were some sequences that we edited while we were shooting just to make sure we had them because you didn't want to leave. We definitely didn't want to leave Kentucky, especially on some of those very specific locations.
Yeah.
Knowing that we weren't going to be able to go back. One of those sequences was Cash versus the Doe in the car, that scene where he comes around and swings around with the trailer house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other one was obviously the final shootout. And the final shootout, we pieced a lot of that together while we were shooting it because it was over days and weeks. And during the shootout, we actually had to shoot half of it and then go away and shoot Cash's cabin and a couple other locations and then come back for a week, I think, and finish it. By the way, that it worked out, yeah.
So there's a lot of bloodshed here. I got to ask about the blood. Did you put this in with visual effects? Or were we using some buckets of blood in this film?
We're buckets of blood, people.
Yes.
Like for us, we for us, there's a practicality, there's a tangibility to everything that's practical. We try to make it as much practical as we can. You know, if blanks are firing out of a gun or glass is exploding behind an actor, they feel that in the performance, and we see that in the performance. So for us, we fight for as much as we can do practical. We don't want to rely. Obviously there's stuff you have to rely on visual effects for, but we try to keep that at a minimum.
Well, I have to commend you on your buckets of blood because of the fact the color of the blood, and a lot of filmmakers overlook this, and they go for cheesy, bright red. But where these bodies are being hit, veins and arteries being hit, it doesn't come out as this bright red Valentine spice candy. It's darker, deeper reds. And that, I love that authenticity and of the color, but it also fed into the darkness that was developing. Just so well done, guys.
Thank you, Debbie. And we love that dark blood. It's what we use. We prefer it. So much love to you. Thank you, Debbie.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
And that was Isham and Ian Nelms talking about Red Right Hand. I encourage you to see the film, especially if you saw Fat Man and you liked what they did with Fat Man. You will love what they're doing with Red Right Hand. If you saw Scott Cooper's film Out of the Furnace with Christian Bale, you will love Red Right Hand. And a real standout in the film is Andie MacDowell, who is pure evil. She is phenomenal in this role of Big Cat. So, check it out. You can see it now. Even Spectrum has it on cable. So, now we're going to switch gears here. And calling in all the way from France is the wonderful Sebastian Drouin. Hello, Sebastian.
Hello, Debbie. How are you?
I am so happy to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I'm calling from France, from Paris.
Okay, so how is Paris looking right now? It should be around
it's raining.
Raining. Well, darn. But the lights.
Freezing and raining.
But the lights of Paris still look beautiful in the rain, though, don't they?
Yeah, it's very romantic if you're an American.
Well, it's still on my bucket list to get to Paris one day.
Yeah, you should go.
But
not during the Olympic Games.
No.
It's going to be a mess.
No, I was in Los Angeles for the 1984 Olympic Games, and it was a mess. No, you don't go anywhere during the Olympic Games. It's a mess. Well, something that everybody can see and love right now is an, oh my God, what a film, Cold Meat. I love this movie, Sebastian. I love it.
Thank you very much.
You caught me by surprise at so many moments in this film. But what you really excelled at in bringing Cold Meat to life is your use is telling a story to using our senses. Your sound design says and sound mix is just impeccable. And it really plays into so much of the tension, the ever-building fear. Sound is a big, big, big part. Having people trapped inside a car, and I can relate to this because as a kid in Philadelphia, this was a great thing to do when there was a blizzard. My dad would let us get and sit inside the car when it was totally covered in like a foot of snow, so you couldn't see out any windows. And as a kid, you think that's the greatest thing in the world, is to be sitting in the car, hiding, and like nobody in a game of hide and seek is going to think to look in the car for you. But somehow when you're an adult, as we see in Cold Meat, being in a car covered in snow and the snow is so built up, you can't see out of any of the windows. And then you have the sound. It's not as much fun as when you're 10 years old. It takes on a whole new terror as an adult. And I love the images that brought up for me. Because it's like, no, I remember doing this when I was a kid. This was really fun. But then as I watch this story unfold, it's not so much fun. This story is amazing. We have, I know you shot it in Canada or British Columbia. Set, though, in the Colorado Rockies.
In Prince George.
Okay, which is beautiful.
It's 1,000 kilometers from Vancouver.
Prince George.
The north of Vancouver.
Ah, Prince George is a beautiful area. Beautiful.
Yeah, the landscape are fantastic.
And it serves quite well for the Colorado Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
And we have this poor guy, David. He just stops at a diner. He wants to get something to eat. The cook is gone, but the waitress will give him a piece of cherry pie. And her ex-husband shows up. And then David decides, well, he's going to intercede and he's going to save her from the argument she's having with her drunk ex-husband. And he succeeds. So, of course, then she's like, oh, would you like a steak? How do you want your steak? I'll turn the oven on. I'll turn the grill on in the kitchen. I'll make you a steak. And you think, hey, this is pretty nice. And then next we see him, he's driving along, he gets gas, and then waitress's ex-husband, Vince, is now tailgating David during a blizzard on a road that was plowed at one point that is rapidly filling up with snow again, and it's getting to be whiteout conditions. And then forces David off the road. And that's when things get really twisted. Sebastian?
don't reveal too much.
No, that's his, that's everybody.
I know it's difficult to talk about that movie without revealing some plot twists.
Yeah.
It's a bit difficult.
Yeah, we don't want to reveal these plot twists, though, because
let's say it's a psychological thriller slash survival movie.
It's definitely
with a little bit of horror elements in it.
Oh yeah, definitely.
But mostly, it's a psychological.
It really is, and it's really interesting to watch how this plays. You have your one location in the car. Now,
yep.
That in and out of itself, as a director, because your co-writer, along with Andrew Desmond and James Kermack, but your director, your editor, and you did the visual effects here.
Color timing.
And that's right. The colorist on this one. And people don't think that, because this is snow, the car is a silver gray. Snow is white, lots of snow. What is there to color? Well, you need to get texture and you need to get color with whites. Whites do have shades of color. So it is very important. So you're doing so many things on this film. Where do you even begin? Once you have the script done and you realize, okay, 90% of the film, 95% of the film takes place in a car. You're limited on space.
Maybe less than that, I guess. 70%, I guess.
But you're limited on available shooting space.
Yep.
Because it's
not... That was the point, because it was a low budget. So it was written on purpose. That means knowing that the budget would be very low. So I decided to write a contained story with few characters and few sets, and but the problem is, it seems easy on the paper, but shooting in the car for 60 minutes of movies, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Talk to me about how you. Once you had the script done, and you're getting ready, and now you have to sit there and figure out how the heck you're going to actually pull this off and shoot this. You're working with your cinematographer, Ryan Peaty, who also,
yep.
For everybody listening, he also shot The Painter, which is very well done. And he's done a lot of Hallmarky kind and Lifetime Christmassy movies. So mm-hmm. He's very good with snow. So you got a win-win here. But how did you and Ryan go about designing your visual grammar and figuring out how you're going to shoot this? Because so much is internalized within the car. And it's not a big luxury car. It's not an SUV.
It's a common car.
Yes, it's a very economical car.
David doesn't want to be noticed.
Right.
He wants to be average guy.
So
he doesn't have a red car or something like that. He wants to be in the middle of the crowd. You know?
So how did you and Ryan go about designing how you were going to shoot this within the car?
So first of all, I spent a lot of time in France working on the script, first alone, then with... James Kermack and Andrew Desmond. But since the beginning, my vision was very clear because I'm a very visual guy. I come from the VFX background.
Mm-hmm.
I did work for 25 years on many big movies as a visual effects supervisor. And I did also as a director a TV series and short movies. But I'm a writer, but I'm very visual. That means when I'm writing, I see how to do the movie. I see my lenses. I know I'm very technical. So I've got a strong technical background, and I was able to speak very quickly and efficiently with Ryan. But when I hired Ryan Petty to do the cinematography of my movie, I trust him a lot, and he gave me some ideas. But everything was storyboarded first. Every shot of the movie was storyboarded, because we had to shoot this movie in only 13 days.
Wow.
And believe me, it's not a lot.
No, it's not.
It's a bit crazy to do that. It's a bit crazy. So there was no place, no room for to try things. We had to be very efficient. And we didn't have any possibility to do extra hours. So it was 13 days, and that's it. So the storyboard was very helpful for all the crew and for Ryan. And then, of course, he did suggest some shots, and sometimes I agreed to do the shot when it was good for the movie. Of course, I'm very open to new ideas and suggestions when they are for the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You see, for when I think it's good, because it's different from being behind your computer writing a movie and behind on the set or on the road in the middle of the snow. You've got new ideas, and so sometimes the storyboard, you don't respect the storyboard 100% all the time, because you have to be very open minded to new things, to what happened, and even to actors' reaction and new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that
that's all we did it in 13 days.
Now, something that you and Ryan do that I really appreciate is you keep giving us different angles within the car. So we're seeing everything inside the car. We're in the glove compartment. We're in the little cup holder thing between the two front seats. We're in the back seat. We're on the floor. We're on the steering wheel. You keep us visually engaged, which I so appreciate, so that we feel the claustrophobia. We feel a lot of what David is feeling.
Now, I'm glad you noticed that kind of detail, because that was very clear to me, and I had an early talk with Ryan about the place, where we're going to put the camera in the car. And I had the strong feeling that we had to have the body of the camera inside the car. That means to shoot a lot with wide lenses and not from outside of the car. And of course, the windows are covered by frost and snow. So that means you can't see through the windows. So if you do a shot through the window, showing the actors, I think the audience feels something is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And my idea was to use the camera as the third person, the third actor in the car. That it's like you are in the car with Anna and David.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's why I really love the fact you kept giving us different angles. So it's as if we were sitting there. You could feel, you can't move your feet anywhere. The back seat, it's a little crowded. You've got, you know, a baby car seat in there. And they're not small. They take up room. And it's not a big car, so there's even less room to navigate around. So you put us in there, and then you take it a step further with your sound. And
the sound is very, very important. I'm glad you noticed that, because for me, the sound is 50% of the movie.
Oh, I agree. Sebastian.
And you can do so many things with the sound.
Oh.
And I was very happy to work with an old friend of mine, called Johan and Antoine. They are old collaborators of mine. They did all my short movie, my TV series also. And we've got a very good relationship, and it's very creative, you know. And I told them I want to. The difficult part of the sound is if the wind you hear outside mm-hmm. is always the same during 60 or 70 minutes, mm-hmm. it can be boring.
Right.
That means the sound has to. You have to have an evolution in the sound, and we did talk about reflecting the mood of the characters. That means when David is in anger, Anna is in anger, you got more whistle and more. Wind, it's like the elements are reflecting
their emotions.
Their emotions, exactly.
And what you also do that, I mean, to give us some sound variance and really create this mm-hmm. beautiful full-bodied palette is every time, because you can't leave the car running and you can't leave the radio on and you can't leave the lights on and you sure can't leave the heat on because it's going to drain the battery. So
yep.
the heat is, turn it on for 10 minutes, turn it on for 15 minutes. And every time it gets turned on, you can hear the heat coming out of the blower. And that touch, that little sonic touch just thrilled me, Sebastian. It thrilled me that you went that deep into the soundscape to bring that. So we were, it's like, okay, suddenly, you know, your hands aren't maybe not quite as frostbitten because you have a momentary respite. But then the minute the heat's off, it also gets a little louder outside too.
Yeah, exactly.
So it is just a spectacular sound mix and balance. But the fact you can't see.
And we did We did the sound mix in Dolby Atmos.
Oh.
And unfortunately, it's not released in Dolby Atmos, but I have a screening at the sound stage in South of France in Dolby Atmos, and the sound was crazy, honestly, because you were totally surrounded by the wind. And the snow on the metal of the car,
mm-hmm.
and it was very immersive, and it's a true character of the movie. It's the third character, I think.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And what intensifies it is the fact that we are in the car and we cannot see what's happening outside. And of course, your mind plays tricks on you. So
exactly.
Is that a tree we hear falling down in the distance? Is somebody walking out in the snow? Your mind reels and we start to hear little things and some big things, too. but it's just the nuance of the sound. That truly thrills me with this film, Sebastian. I can't tell you. It's wonderful. And that melded with your visuals, you send our imaginations reeling as to possibilities of what could happen. When we see what does happen, we're shocked. You've got some real jump in your seat moments here. You really built tension, and surprised
what
us.
I like to do as a filmmaker and also as an audience myself. Or I'm a movie fan. I love to be thrilled. I love suspense. I'm a big fan of Hitchcock movies, and by extension Spielberg, because he did borrow a lot to Hitchcock,
mm-hmm.
and Zemeckis also. And Brian De Palma, you see, all those guys, because they play with the audience. They stretch each scene. So So you are very into tension, and you don't know what will happen next. And I like to be like that as a viewer myself.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. Now, another important thing that we see happening here is the makeup work. As we are seeing from the frigid cold, I don't care if you're in a car, it's still freezing, below freezing. The wind is howling. The snow is blowing. It's whiteout conditions. And your face is exposed. Your hands may be exposed. You are going to have frostbite setting in. And we see that. And it's done incrementally so that we get the feeling of the passage of time. The makeup work is spectacular.
Yeah, the makeup artist was Ikara, I don't pronounce well, sorry, Ikara the Gamache Award. And she did a fantastic job. And I was very scared by the makeup because I knew I had to shoot a lot with close-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And with the digital definition today, if the makeup is not good enough, you see all the little details, and it can be very distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did different tests, and she did also the broken leg, and it was fantastic. And she really did an amazing job on this movie, because it's very difficult to do it, to make it believable, and not too much distracting. You see what I mean?
Yes. Yes. And
if you see the movie again, you see all the little cracks on the lips, all the veins,
mm-hmm.
All the effect of on the frost on the fingers, on the top of the nose, the earlobes, all that stuff.
Every place.
Really. And for all the movie, we decide to do different steps. Mm-hmm. Of frost effects.
Yeah, so we see the progression.
More you're going through the movie, the more you've got strong effects of the frost.
Yeah, I love the fact that we see the progression, so we know time is passing.
Yeah. Exactly.
And frostbite, when it comes quick. It doesn't take too long. But, you know, all these sensory elements. But of course, none of this would work were it not for, you've got to have an actor playing David who is believable, who can turn on a dime, who is ambiguous in his persona. And for that, you get Alan Leach. And I have to say, I'm looking at this and I'm watching and I'm like, I know that guy. I know that guy. And then it dawned on me. Oh,
yeah,
he was the skeevy dirtbag Paul in Bohemian Rhapsody. So
exactly,
I'm like, all right, but he looks so mild mannered, and I love the way you have him playing with glasses. He has his glasses on when we first see him. He's in the diner. He takes them off. It's really interesting, the little ticks and the little nuances that Alan brings to David. But once I realized who it was, it's like, okay, let's see what kind of skeevy stuff he does here.
He's surprising. Very surprising.
And of course, Nina Bergman is Anna.
Yeah.
She is really an emotional powerhouse.
Exactly.
You give her a great arc.
I was very lucky to work with Nina Bergman and Alan Leach and Yann Toile, who plays Vincent.
Yeah.
Yann Toile, I knew Yann Toile from my TV series. We are friends and he's a very intense actor. And I knew that with the little time he has on screen, he's got 10 minutes on screen,
mm-hmm.
but I knew it was important to have someone very intense, so you the trick works. I can't say too much, but he has to be very convincing, you see,
yes,
in a short time.
Yes.
But I didn't know Alan. I mean, personally, I didn't know Alan Leach and Nina. And I choose to work with Alan because I knew that I needed someone who was very good, who has very intense voice, mm-hmm, and intense eyes. Because yeah, David is mostly strapped to the wheel during all the movie. That means he has no way to express himself except his voice, mm-hmm, and his eyes.
Yeah,
and you have to see through his eyes that he's very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan is very smart.
Anna's very very smart.
You feel it. You feel it is a danger because you see, okay, he's going to find a way to free himself.
What I find really
So it's a real danger. And Nina is the opposite. Nina is very emotional. And she's a, if you know her personally, she's a warrior, you know. And I told to Nina, I told, okay, I don't want to see your warrior side at the beginning. I want to see your normal side, your victim side.
Mm-hmm.
And then the warrior side will come at the end. You see? So that's the arc of your character.
And it plays beautifully.
But Nina was very emotional.
It plays beautifully, Sebastian, to watch her and the journey she goes on.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And we see power dynamics shifting.
Uh-huh.
And I love the fact that David is always in, he's sitting in the driver's seat of the car. But you have to wonder, is David really in the driver's seat from a metaphoric standpoint? You give us these layers, these thematic layers, mm-hmm, that are just so wonderful to see unfold. Now, I have to ask you, how challenging was the editing on this one? Because you're editing and you're
yeah,
directing it. So because you would be editing it, did you wait till you shot everything? Were you editing in your head as you went? What was the editing process like? Because with one primary location in a car, you've got to keep it interesting. You want to keep things moving. You want to keep the audience engaged. And you want your actors, your characters to be engaged too. So talk to me about the editing process.
First of all, I have an editor background. So I edit my own movie since a long time. I was hesitating to edit this movie because it was my first long feature.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know if it was a good idea. But at the same time, it was a low-budget movie. So I decided to do it, to try things, to spend more time in the editing room that we could afford with hiring a professional editor, you see. So it was more comfortable for me to do the editing. And honestly, I love editing. This is the best part for me. Because you are in your room. You know, it's like you are alone with yourself, with your rushes, and you can test things and do many variations. But the editing the was very clear in my mind since the writing, because I knew that I didn't have any extra takes. We shot most of the movie with 1, 2, 3 takes max.
Wow.
Because we have to shoot in 13 days, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So the difficulty was to choose the good takes, because honestly, with Alan and Nina, all the takes were good. So it was difficult. I say, oh, I've got this variation. It's interesting. And this one is interesting, too. I have to choose. And I send an email to Alan. I say, you put me in difficulties. because all the texts are good. What can I do?
Oh.
And so I choose the best one. I choose to first do a long version of the movie, which was 1 hour and 35 minutes. And then I showed the movie to different people around me, to people I trust, and to my producer.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave me some feedbacks. And when we decided to reduce the beginning before the twist.
Okay.
And I did cut 10 minutes of the movie here.
Wow.
So there was a little bit of pacing problem in the middle, and I decided to cut a little bit some obvious replies. Sometimes it's too on the nose or it's too obvious, and just a look of David is enough to answer a question or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've got so much close-ups that it says a lot.
Well, you know,
it's better than any dialogue.
You're in a car. We're staying in the car. You're going to have close-ups.
yeah, of course. but I have to say, I had the tempo, the pace of the movie very quickly, and the tone. The tone of the movie is a bit sarcastic.
Mm-hmm.
There is a kind of dark humor in it. It's my dark humor.
It does have...
All my movies are like that.
Especially, I'd say, around the midpoint of the film. While we're in the second act, before we get into the third act, where talking is happening.
Yeah.
And there is some... It is almost sarcastic.
It is sarcastic.
In the way the cadence and the tone, the vocal tones are. And it's like a cat and mouse game, almost.
Exactly. It tries to have some power over her.
But it's just everything about this film, Sebastian, is so well done. You know.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious. Was there any kind of learning curve for you, though? This was your first directorial feature-length film. Was there a learning curve of any? You know, of any import here?
Yeah, I learn. Of course, you learn. Each time you shoot a movie, you learn something. And I didn't learn to shoot quickly because I did it before on my TV series. I shot 100 minutes in 12 days previously. So, but what I did learn is to trust my actor. And at the beginning, I was a bit stressed, to be honest,
mm-hmm.
because I knew we met with Alan and Nina. We met only 3 days before the shooting.
Oh, 3 whole days, huh? Oh, my God.
Yeah, suddenly, you know, 2 weeks before the shooting, okay, we've got a green light. What? You're leaving France, you're going to Canada Monday. What? Okay?
Oh, and
then it was rushing every day. And I met Alan and Nina 3 days before. So we had only 3 days of rehearsal. So they didn't met before. So I made a gamble here, you see. Maybe there was no alchemy between them.
Mm-hmm.
And it did work. So the alchemy was good between them. But I had to introduce myself and to find a way to work with Alan and Nina. And they are very different. Different way of working. I was a bit stressed, so and because I had this movie in my mind since 7 years at that time, 7 years or 8 years, so I was very precise, and I didn't let enough space for them. So after a few minutes, they told me, okay, let us just show you what we have in mind, because we did some homework. I said, okay, I was a bit surprised. And they show me a big scene, a 20-minute long scene in one take in the lobby of the hotel. And I realized that they knew the character better than me.
Wow.
I mean, in the emotion. And I just correct some things, and I show them some serial killer interviews I had on my laptop, just to show the level of creepiness, you can say that, creepiness, that's what, and the level of evil of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And because David was inspired by two famous American serial killers, Gerhard Schaefer and Ed Kemper.
Oh my God!
And so it was a mix. It was a mix, and some details came directly from the interview.
Wow!
And I show them. I say, "Wow, that's crazy! This guy is pure evil." I say, and you see during the interview that the guy is very sarcastic. He enjoys telling his story.
Yeah,
and it's really creepy. Believe me.
Oh.
And you can find the interviews on the internet. And I said to them, okay, this is the tone of the movie, you see. And then it was okay. I trust them. I saw that they knew the character very well. And it was a pleasure to work with them. And, of course, you do a little bit of more like that, or more sarcastic, or more straight, or more. But it was very easy. And the only thing we changed at the end, they came with, you know, the big monologue at the end.
Yes.
First, David is talking, and then Nina is talking.
Mm-hmm.
And on Nina's monologue, they told me that what I wrote with James and Andrew was not right. They said she can't talk about someone we've never seen in the movie. It was a third person.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of her, but that person is not in the movie. And they say it should be related to her experience. And they did a rewriting together, and they show me the scene and say, we want, what do you think about that? And I say, sold. It's sold. It's better than my version. So it's okay. Do it. It's more emotional. And I have to say that scene is I think it's the best scene of the movie.
Oh, my God.
Because it's so emotional.
That third act and that monologue you're talking about, it is extremely,
yeah.
It's extremely powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way it plays out, it's like you're going to jump in your chair. You're going to jump.
That's the point.
Because you give us this great twist. Just beginning to end, Sebastian, this is a wonderful film. I will admit I have watched it twice. I watched it once with the screening link that Kim sent me,
yeah?
But then I paid $6.99 to watch it again on cable.
Okay.
Because I really liked it. And I wanted a second chance to appreciate the great sound design.
But if you see the film a second time, it's very funny because you've got little details.
Yes.
You missed at the beginning and say, oh, that moment.
Yes.
Now I understand why he does that.
Yes. And this,
I built the movie like that. That means if people rewind the movie, they will notice that everything was under their nose.
Yes. This is one of those movies that you really do want to see more than once. Because once you see how everything plays out and you see the twists and turns, then you can go back and watch it and see the breadcrumbs that you give us that lead up to
exactly.
it. So, job so well done. I hope you're going to make another feature soon, Sebastian.
I hope so. I hope so. I'm working on it, in fact.
Well, good. This has been an absolute delight talking with you today about Cold Meat. I love this film. I hope that we get to chat again in the future. And you called and you called all the way from Paris for us.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
I'm in LA for the work, but I haven't been in LA since 5 years.
Wow.
But I used to work there. I used to work for a visual effect company there. And, so I know Los Angeles very well.
Well, but Paris is better. Paris is better. unless it's raining and cold.
not for the weather. The weather is better in LA. Believe me.
Oh, Sebastian, thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
And hopefully
it was a pleasure.
We will chat again in the future.
Yeah, I hope so.
Oh.
For the next movie.
Fingers crossed. Have a wonderful evening, Sebastian.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And as usual, Behind the Lens goes global once again. Sebastian Drouin talking about his film Cold Meat. That's so lovely. He called us from Paris. You know, Timur has called us from Moscow, from Italy. Yeah, we've had people call from Australia, Ireland, the UK, Paris. I think this is our second filmmaker to call us from Paris. I love going global. All right, well, that is all the time we have today. Of course, we ran over. Next week, we're going to be talking about, what is it? Next week, the Omicron killer. And haven't decided which exclusive interview you're going to get to hear. But I'll work on that this week. So, go see Red Right Hand. See Air Force One Down. See the brilliant Barry Pepper in Bring Him to Me. And definitely see Cold Meat. Everything, they're all out digitally. Some are still in theaters. Find them, see them. You will enjoy all of them. And if you haven't picked your copy up yet and read it, John Lindstrom's Hollywood Hustle. All you General Hospital fans, get it and read it. And don't forget, if you're in LA and you're hungry for some LTC, all-natural beef jerky, head on over to Mom's Bar on Santa Monica Boulevard and pick yours up. So, until next week, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.